6 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have two cases scheduled on the 9 a.m. docket this morning, Copley versus Robinson and Rayer, I hope I pronounced that correctly, versus State Farm. Are counsel ready and present to proceed in both of those cases? All checked in?
Yes, Your Honor.
Great. You should have all received a set of written instructions when you checked in detailing our oral argument procedures. Let me just ask right now if any of the counsel present on those two cases have any questions about those instructions or our procedures. Okay. What we'll do is we'll hear argument in the Copley case first, and then we'll go to the Rayer case. I'd remind counsel to identify themselves by name and attorney registration number when you come to the podium. Also, I'd like to make sure that if anybody has a cell phone or a pager or anything like that, please turn it off now so as not to interrupt counsel and court during oral argument. And with that, we're ready to begin argument in Copley versus Robinson.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rob Working. For the record, that's spelled W-E-R-K-I-N-G, registration number 22106. And I'm proud to stand and give voice to Mr. Copley in this matter. Off to my right-hand side is Eric Wessels, who's also an attorney of record in this case and has been of very much assistance. This is an interesting case in the fact of due process. This comes in the context of a concealed weapons permitting process. And on April 7th of 2008, over a year ago, Sheriff J. Grayson Robinson denied Robert Copley's permit for a concealed weapon. Now, if you put this in context, and I know that you've read the briefs and the record, well, Mr. Copley had been issued a concealed weapons permit back in March, March 17th of 2005. He had been issued this permit, he had been declared to be eligible, meeting the statutory requirements to be issued this concealed weapons permit, and he held that permit until it was revoked on April 24th of 2007. The reason the permit was revoked is Mr. Copley was charged with a Class 3 misdemeanor trespass violation. Okay, being charged with the trespass violation in and of itself does not cause the revocation of the permit. What causes the revocation of the permit is anytime a person is charged with a Title 18 violation in the state of Colorado, which is a criminal violation, a mandatory protection order pursuant to 18-1-1001 is issued. Because this mandatory protection issue was issued, Mr. Copley was no longer eligible during this time period or during the pendency of this misdemeanor case to hold the concealed weapons permit. Mr. Copley fought for his innocence. He maintained his innocence during the pendency of this misdemeanor trespass case. And in fact, the case was dismissed outright. This was not a dismissal as part of a plea agreement. It was not a dismissal as part of a deferred judgment and sentence or some other type of deferred prosecution. It was an outright dismissal. The prosecution came on the morning of jury and said that we have no reasonable likelihood of obtaining a conviction in this case based upon the evidence. The case was dismissed.
There's some statement in the briefs that the reason that they did that was that the victim or the key witness had died. Is that correct?
That is correct. There were witness problems in the case. A witness had died, and the prosecution, again, could not go forward, had no reasonable likelihood of conviction in the case. Case was dismissed. Following dismissal, Mr. Copley went back, approached the county, and approached the sheriff and said, I want to reapply for my concealed weapons permit. He, in fact, spoke with a Deputy Garner in the Sheriff's Department, spoke with him directly, and Deputy Garner advised that what we need from you is we need the court disposition, a certified court disposition showing the case had been dismissed. Once you provide that to us, then we'll review your file and make a decision. Mr. Copley did, in fact, comply with what the sheriffs had asked for. He provided the notice that the case had been dismissed, certified copies of this dismissal. He reapplied for, filled out the applications for his concealed weapons permit. And of note, he was completely eligible. There is no statutory criteria that he could be denied. right? He has proficiency with a firearm. He's over the age of 21. There's no longer this mandatory protection order. There's no longer any sort of statutory criteria that would prohibit him or make him ineligible to hold a firearm.
Counsel, can I interrupt for just a second?
Yes.
We're so short on the amount of time, and I want to jump ahead from the facts a little bit and talk about a couple of the legal issues, because this statute is not a model of clarity by any means. Let me talk about the record first, or ask a question about the record. All we have in front of us is the sheriff's two orders. We have an exchange of correspondence, a letter back to your client saying you can either show up for a hearing or an interview, or you can just let the sheriff decide on the papers. We have nothing else. So whose responsibility is it to give us the record, whatever? Apparently there was a tape recording. We don't have that. We don't have your client's application materials. We don't have the Gardner report. We don't have anything other than the two orders. So whose responsibility is it to give us the record?
And I appreciate that, and that's cutting to the chase, isn't it? Pursuant to the concealed weapon permitting statute, referring specifically to 1812-207, in this case, because the denial was based upon this notion of danger to himself or others if issued the permit, the statute, 1812-207, subsection 3, states specifically, if the denial, suspension, or revocation was based on the sheriff's determination that the person would be a danger as provided in 1812-203, subsection 2, the sheriff, the county, the government, shall have the burden of proving the determination by clear and convincing evidence. The sheriff bears the burden of bringing forth the evidence in this case. It never switches on to, and let's compare that to, as the county would say, this is a 106 case. They would say that this is a 106 record review case in which, pursuant to Rule 106 of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure, the plaintiff is to have a certified record submitted and call for that. And then the plaintiff bears the burden of going through the record and demonstrating to the court that there is no evidentiary support in the record and that the governmental body decision is so devoid of evidentiary support that it's arbitrary and capricious. That is not the case here. This is a different beast in which the statute and the legislatures specifically designed it and said that the sheriff bears the burden of proof in this case.
But it doesn't say anything about, subsection 3 says absolutely zero about the record. And so I'm trying to come to grips with how do you make consistent, or can you make consistent, subsection 3 and subsection 2, which says the procedures for filing all the things that are supposed to be in a 106, and indeed it mentions 106, shall apply in this case. And one of those procedures is, if the plaintiff wants to, he can ask for a certified record of what happened at the in the administrative hearing.
Right, but in a 106 case, say for a liquor license case or a planning commission, a land use case, the plaintiff, of course, has the burden of demonstrating that there's no evidence in the record. And so the burden is on the plaintiff to get the record and then show that there's no evidentiary support in the record. Here, that's a different beast, right? We follow the 106 procedures, but not the substance. And the substance here is clear that the burden is on the sheriff, on Sheriff Robinson, to provide you with the evidence. And not just any evidence, it's got to be evidence of a clear and convincing standard.
Okay, so let me move ahead to another issue and talk about that burden issue a little bit. I know that there's a big issue in this case, and you argued below and you argue here that you should have gotten a full-blown de novo evidentiary hearing. Let's say that we disagree with you on that. I still have a question about the whole burden issue. Subsection 3 makes it clear that the sheriff has a burden to prove something, and it's that something I want to ask about by clear and convincing evidence. So let's say the court was properly limited to a record review of what happened at the administrative hearing. The language in subsection 3, in terms of what the sheriff is supposed to prove by clear and convincing evidence, is different from the language in another section of the statute which talks about what the sheriff has to find. So how do you, what is it that the, what's this determination that has to be proved by clear and convincing evidence?
Right, there is a conflict. And in this, in the permitting statute itself, there is an internal conflict. In one section, the judicial review section, as you've noted, it's clear and convincing evidence. In this 1812-201 part two, I'm sorry, 1812-203, subsection two, this is where it says that the burden is on the sheriff to establish a reasonable belief that documented previous behavior by the applicant makes it likely the applicant will present a danger to self or others if the applicant receives a permit to carry a concealed handgun.
Right.
So in either event, the sheriff has this burden of coming forward. And whether, I mean, the internal inconsistencies, we would state that because this is tied to a constitutional right and that of self-protection, and the legislative declaration of this permitting statute says specifically this is tied to a constitutional right, we would suggest that the standard is the clear and convincing evidentiary standard.
Well, I know that. The question is clear and convincing evidence of what?
Well,
is it clear and convincing evidence that the sheriff had a reasonable belief, or is it clear and convincing evidence that the applicant would be a danger?
Well, that's right.
Which is
it? It's here that the documented previous behavior by the applicant makes it likely the applicant will present a danger to self or others if issued a concealed weapons permit. It's one, right, we can't dissect or say danger to self or others. It's danger if issued this permit. And that is the burden. I mean, where is the documented evidence? And it gets back, circles back to, there's nothing in the record. There is no evidence that has been brought forward by the sheriff in this case documenting anything. The only thing that you have is an August 2th after remand, right? In this case, the sheriff issued a blanket denial, said denied. Didn't give a reason for it, didn't state it, even the grounds, didn't even state the statute, said denied. 106 is filed, and on judicial review, then it was remanded for the sheriff to actually provide some sort of criteria, some sort of guidance for the court on what this denial was based on. And it wasn't until the remand that the sheriff then had time to go back and submit his findings of fact. Well, the findings of fact are not evidence. And if the sheriff has to come forward with clear and convincing evidence showing that there's this previous documented behavior, there's been an absolute failure here. There has been no evidence submitted whatsoever. Right? The findings by the sheriff, in and of themselves, that's not evidence. And what's interesting, and this gets into the due process and the real interesting issue here, what's interesting is the sheriff refers to documents and secret memorandums that have never been disclosed. Right? There, the evidence that the sheriff claims is out there is in a secret Garner memorandum that to this day has never been brought to this court, to the lower court. It's never been, and more importantly, and this court is important, mind you, but more importantly, it's never been brought up to Robert Copley, the applicant. Mr. Copley has a due process right, procedural due process. He's at least given notice in the time of the hearing, but a substantive due process right to know what the hearing's about. And he walked into this ambush. He was sandbagged by walking into the sheriff's office with no knowledge that there's this secret memorandum out there that he has to answer to, right? And the secret memorandum doesn't even, it hasn't been submitted, but it doesn't name names. It talks about reputation evidence. It doesn't even talk about who these people are, who the declarant of this reputation evidence is. We've never had a chance to cross-examine them. We've never had a chance to bring forth our own evidence to rebut this secret memorandum. And that's the issue here.
If the trial court and ultimately I think the sheriff in their brief on appeals say, well, your client's testimony by itself was enough. How do you respond to that?
And that's right. In this case, Judge Speer found that the sheriff's testimony Coughley went into this hearing. He wasn't provided notice of what this hearing was about, other than the misdemeanor charge. And then he was asked questions. And this transcript of this hearing has not been submitted as evidence. But snippets have been taken out of that, out of the questions that Mr. Copley has been asked, and taken out of context and put before you and said, see, this shows that he inserts himself in law enforcement. Well, one, if the burden is documented previous behavior, that's what the standard is. How is it that you can have an applicant come in for a concealed weapon permit, ask them questions, not on documented previous behavior, and then say, well, his answers make me feel that it's likely he's going to be a danger to himself or others? That's not documented previous evidence. And the fact is that Mr. Copley went in there with this notice that he would be questioned about this misdemeanor case that had been dismissed, and all along he'd never been given notice that the sheriff was going to come in and ask questions about this internal secret memorandum. And that is the problem. And it's not fair to Mr. Copley to have to answer those types of things and then use it against him and say his own testimony, his own voice at this hearing makes it appear that he's a danger to himself or others.
Thank you, Mr. Working.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. George Rosenberg, 4507, on behalf of the Sheriff, Sheriff Robinson of Arapahoe County. Would sum it up, this case, this way. Did the sheriff have a reasonable belief, based on clear and convincing evidence, that Mr. Copley was a danger to himself or to others? The sheriff is charged with a heavy responsibility of protecting the community when he considers issuing a concealed handgun permit to an individual. The sheriff is not required to wait for a permit holder to become an actual danger to himself or others. Then it's too late. The sheriff has the duty and the right to form a reasonable belief based on clear and convincing evidence that a permit holder is a danger to himself or others.
Let me stop you right there.
Yes, Your Honor.
The clear and convincing evidence standard shows up in only one place, subsection 3 of section 207. It isn't anywhere to be found in the previous sections. I think it's section, I can't remember which it is, section 202 or 203, where it talks about the reasonable belief. So I'm still confused how you square those two things. I mean, where does it say that the sheriff, in making his original determination, has to find anything by clear and convincing evidence?
I would agree with Your Honor, other than that one reference.
And the one reference doesn't refer to the sheriff, refers to judicial review, says that's what the court has to find.
That's what's confusing. This is basically new ground. The statute isn't that old, and basically this may be the first case on this statute, and in particular on revocation. So there's that interplay between 106 and what this specific statute says.
I understand.
And that's already been raised this morning. The problem one has is the case law seems to indicate that at this level, the court doesn't look at what the district court did, but rather goes back to the original administrative hearing. And that's what all the standards and considerations are applied to, not the district court's decision. And that's what we've argued in our brief, or at least pointed out. If, on the other hand, this court's going to look at, no, what did the district court do, then I think we have different standards to apply.
Well, from a practical standpoint, it sounds to me like what you're arguing is that even though Section 203 doesn't say anything about clear and convincing evidence, if a sheriff makes a denial decision or a revocation decision and doesn't want it to be overturned, and from a practical standpoint, the sheriff has got to say somewhere that he found what he found by clear and convincing evidence. Otherwise, how is it ever going to be upheld?
That's one way of looking at it. On the other hand, I wouldn't argue with the court if the court is saying, well, the clear and convincing evidence standard doesn't necessarily come into play in this particular specific case.
But to do that, we've got to ignore language specifically used by the General Assembly, and I think we're loath to do something like that.
And I think that's probably the, well, put it bluntly, the frustration that the parties, as well as the court, finds itself dealing with.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So, let's look at a few specific things here. The plaintiff did not challenge the sheriff's rendition in the sheriff's order of the plaintiff's testimony. The evidence, as I said, has been rendered by the sheriff in his findings of fact. Now, the findings of fact, technically speaking, no, that's not the evidence. Rather, it's a recitation of the evidence that the sheriff relied on. For argument's sake, we'll say we're not conceding that the reference to the deputy statements could not be relied upon. But for argument's sake, eliminate the deputy's statements. There's still sufficient evidence remaining for the sheriff to meet the standard of review and still come out with the finding that he did, that the applicant, the permittee, was a danger either to himself or to others.
Mr. Rosenberg, I take your argument to mean that the evidence was sufficient that there was a danger. Can you articulate from those findings what was the danger?
If you look at the part of it is incorporated in the district court's order, or if we go back to the subject order of the sheriff, which is before the court, that is in the record. And going down the findings in bullet points, there were instances, and this comes from the plaintiff's own testimony. There were confrontations, he interjected himself. In effect, he was acting like or attempting to act like a law enforcement officer, which he doesn't contend that he is or ever was. And this, I think a sheriff or chief of police has a right to become very concerned and alarmed about. That's the very thing I think that concerns the sheriffs when they're considering issuing the permits. That always is kind of in the back of their mind. Well, you know, are the application process, the background checks, there's no requirement to do intensive psychological examination. And so that's a worry you have. So here's a situation where plaintiff, by his own words, said, well, I've been involved in these situations, I've been involved in those situations, and it rose to the level where the sheriff felt he had no choice. In fact, he was required to revoke the permit.
Where do you get to the argument that he was required to do so?
I think, again, the General Assembly put in the provision of danger to himself or to others, and with that, the discretion to the sheriff that if you form a reasonable belief based on, if not the substantial, I'm sorry, the clear and convincing, then at least if you use the normal 106 standard, substantial evidence in the record, that he had no choice. Again, it comes back to, is the sheriff to wait until something happens? Let's say he didn't revoke this permit, and something very bad happened subsequently. I think that's why the sheriff did what he did. That's why the sheriff has to do that.
Well, I want to pursue that a little bit. As I understand how the statute is written, even if the sheriff finds that an applicant is likely to be a danger to himself or others, under the statutory language, he still it says he may deny the permit. So he has this, even if he makes that finding, he doesn't have to. So I'm trying to understand where you're coming to the position that he, once he made that finding, he had to deny the permit.
Well, if one, as the court stated early on, the statute isn't the most helpful, either to the sheriff himself or to the applicants or to the courts. There was also, if one looks at the legislative history, which I realize is not before the court, but let me generalize it. Things dealing with handguns, and in particular concealment or concealed permits relating to handguns, very controversial, very charged issue. And this law in this state is no exception to what's going on all over the country. Let me say one thing real quickly here. Handguns have only one ultimate purpose. That's to kill people with or without a legal basis. So I think the legislature was balancing the, or attempting to balance the Second Amendment issues on right to bear arms. I think it's pointed out in our briefs. However, specifically in Colorado, there's no constitutional right to a concealed handgun permit. So they give this discretion to the sheriff, and that's kind of a funny thing that you can find the person's a danger to himself or to others, but you don't necessarily have to revoke their permit. That doesn't make a lot of sense, but I would, at least speaking specifically for my client, and that's what he in fact did, it wasn't a question of me. And I think we have that situation in our case law where may can sometimes mean shall. I'm not saying that's the case here. But if it's not disputed that the sheriff has the discretion, if this particular sheriff in his discretion says, when I find, I form the reasonable belief based upon the proper evidentiary standard, then I have no choice.
Mr. Rosenberg, let me ask you something on a different point. It's my understanding that the memo written by Deputy Garner was not provided to Mr. Copley. Do you dispute that?
No, we don't dispute it, but our position is you can take that out, and there is still substantial, significant evidence remaining upon which the sheriff can form his reasonable belief.
Well, let me follow up on that statement. What evidence are you talking about? What evidence was in the record before the district court from the administrative hearing the sheriff conducted in which the sheriff determined that Mr. Copley would be a danger to himself or others? What evidence is in the record?
It was in the form of, in summary form or rendition, and that was in the findings of fact, the statements by the plaintiff, which have not been disputed, where he said, well, I showed up, I believe one was in, he somehow interjected himself in an eviction proceeding.
But isn't that what the sheriff said, Mr. Copley said?
That's correct.
That's not a transcript of what Mr. Copley said.
No, it is not. But there was certainly an opportunity for the plaintiff to say, that's not what I said. The sheriff has it all wrong, or the sheriff made it up. And this is the first time this morning where there's been any challenge that, or some kind of allusion that, well, things were taken out of context. There were much better opportunities previous to this morning for the plaintiff to raise those issues. And we believe at this point, the court has to take it on face value that the sheriff's summary rendition, whatever term you want to use, of what Mr. Copley testified to stands as valid evidence.
Did Mr. Copley challenge in the district court proceedings whether or not these statements or summaries were evidence? You say that he didn't challenge the content of the statements, but did he challenge the fact that they were evidence to begin with?
No, because there was no plaintiff had requested that the trial court allow first a de novo hearing, and I believe the plaintiff was even willing to have a more limited or narrow hearing, not a de novo, but at least an opportunity to go over, quote, the record. The sheriff argued against that. The district court agreed with the sheriff's arguments that under 106, you're not entitled, a party's not entitled to a de novo. District court could have conceivably had some type of hearing on the briefs, chose not to, simply allowed the parties to submit briefs, and but in that briefing, plaintiff did not challenge the what I'm calling the rendition of the evidence.
So, Mr. Rosenberg, am I understanding you correctly to say that the district court would have been proper to have a hearing on the briefs?
I think it under 106, the court could have had a limited hearing, not for the purpose of taking any new evidence. Basically, just hearing legal arguments.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenberg.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your very excellent arguments. Case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Counsel on the Copley case are excused. And